This just came in the mail. I thought you might be interested in knowing that you can now buy a set of Praying Hands salt and pepper set. You've probably seen the sculpture of Duryea. And I quote to you from the advertisement. It says, an inspiring reproduction of Duryea's, that's D-U-R-E-R, Duryea's, immortal masterpiece, a lovely work of art, these Praying Hands. Every time you sit down to a meal, and you sprinkle salt on your tomatoes or sprinkle a little pepper in your pepperoni, you will be making a pious gesture. And the idea of having Praying Hands salt and pepper shakers, I think... Do you realize what future generations, like 1,000 years from now, when they have this in the museum, you know, you've seen these Praying Hands like so. I think it's kind of great. That's true slob art. That's slob art. There's a whole category of slob art that could be called pious slob art. I mean, let's say piety is the driving factor in it. And nowhere but in America does this rise to such tremendous heights. So please, will you, if you will, art every day, you sneak it in there. I'll give me a little salute tonight to the basic slob that's down deep within each one of us. The fat, belching slob that sits within the soul of each man, waiting to be left out. You've heard, of course, the old expression that within every fat man, there's a thin man trying to escape. Well, I would say within every civilized man, there's a slob sitting around picking his teeth, waiting to be heard, too. Yes. Thank you, Alice. Very nice. We'd like to salute that side of us, the slobs. And by the way, speaking of the pious side of slob art, have you ever run into this one? I'll never forget. I used to do a commercial one time in a Midwestern television and radio station that had the following commercial, which I thought was kind of indicative of the whole thing. I became a student of the pious subdivision of slob art at that time. Very few people have documented it because it can be kind of dangerous. But this particular commercial came out and said, friends, you had it says, deliver in dialect. It said, friends, have you ever envied those friends and neighbors of yours who get real help out of reading the Bible, who get actual practical help out of the Bible? Well, the Everlast Ever Protecting Bible Corporation of Peoria, Illinois, now makes available to you a Bible with a genuine bulletproof, knife-proof, leather-covered cover that will just protect you from knife fights, protect you in gun fights, and all them other problems that you run into on Saturday night. Now, this bobble is guaranteed to save you at a moment when you need saving more than any other time. Now, you send your name and address to Savior in care of this. Well, I kind of liked doing that. And you'd be surprised the number we sold. Then there was another one that came on like this. It says, friends, have you felt that the true religion is leaving American life every day, and more people are leaving the church? More and more people are forgetting the nature of the true religious aura and aspect of our basic American life. Well, the Last Supper Tablecloth Company of East Wichita, Kentucky, now makes available to you a beautiful oilcloth tablecloth in four magic colors that is in life size, that you are sitting down every night when you break bread in that simple, humble home of yours. You're breaking bread with the Last Supper, and the Lord is sitting there right beside you. You'll see Judas looking with his sneaky eyes over towards your praying hand salt and pepper set. You'll see St. Peter getting ready to say the good word to the Lord. And as you sit down with that Last Supper tablecloth spread out before you, you'll be reminded of the basic Christian heritage that is part of your life. I thought to myself, you know, we used to sell those tablecloths. Now, you think that's kind of a bad thing to talk about, but very few people. I figured that tonight, since, you know, it's the middle of July, there's hardly anybody listening, and everybody's off on vacation, we can talk about some of the nitty-gritty stuff. No, I understand that. You can talk about nitty-gritty type things, you know, like, for example, the slobism that's connected with certain aspects of our life. For example, the other night, and this is something you never hear on the sports cast, you know, the sports is getting really big in America, and in fact, it's getting so big that sports today is one of the major businesses in America. It's up there with steel. It's up there with, it is, it really is. I'm not kidding. It's up there with steel. It's up there with automobiles. And eventually, I think sports will be listed on the big board. You'll be able, you know, there'll be shares available in the Jets. You'll be able to buy shares in Chris Schenkel Enterprises. And, you know, Kurt Gowdy is far bigger today than any movie star. Do you agree with that? No question about it. He is. He really is. So this, I'm right, absolutely right. So this is an important thing. That has crept up on us, like on little cat's feet, without any heralding, without any cheers. It just sort of sneaked up on us. Now, what is part of the whole sports scene that gives it its piquant flavor, that makes it different than, let's say, a poetry reading at the YMHA? And by the way, have you noticed that today we confuse sports with games? Very interesting. Have you noticed Bobby Fischer now has become a sports figure, the chess player? And actually, he's a game player, not the same as sports, not at all. It's like confusing checkers with football. Merely because there's competition does not make it a sport. No, it's not even the matter of money. No. A sport is a different, a whole different process than a game. And particularly when it involves a game of intellect. It's not a sport. I'm sorry, friend. Well, of course, there you go. You're always getting into trouble, Shepherd, doing that kind of stuff. So we will not even touch upon the religious aspect of sports today, which is of major importance in our time. And I'd like to go on record here tonight, though, as saying that there's one element of sports which, of course, differentiated from a game, and that is the combative element of the actual spectator as opposed to the participant. And that's a big thing. In fact, it's what makes going to a ball game interesting. Because all around you, sitting up there in the stands, all around you are friends and enemies. You can't tell one from the other. They're they look like ball fans, but they're not. They're partisan. And some of the biggest riots that have occurred in Europe in the past 75 years have occurred as a result of sporting events. You agree with me there, Al? I mean, like 150 people killed. I'm talking about the big scene. I mean, if there was a riot where 150 people were killed because of a new law or something in Scotland, that would be fantastic headlines. But they have had like 100 people killed in the middle of a giant hassle over a football game, you know, a soccer game. Oh, I tell you, they wind up burning down a stand. You go to a place like in Argentina, for example, it's not totally uncommon for them to have to call out the fire department, seven regiments of National Guard troops, guys with hoses, rubber cannons, and everything else, to clear away the howling mob after a bad decision in a football game. Now, that is part of sports, right? So tonight, once again, we would like to pay homage to that unsung character in the sporting world who makes sports what it is. Please, if you will, a little salute music, Al.
Let it burn. Hooray, hooray, hooray for the U.S. of A. Hooray, hooray, as we march ever upward and onward. Upward and onward we go. Yeah, hooray. Upward and onward we go. Oh, hooray, 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 hooray. Bring it up big there.
So tonight we would like to salute those soreheads and those boobirds everywhere. Whose slogan is not how you play the game, it's whether you win or not. Now remember, friends, that is the base. Thank you. Thank you, Al. That's the basic philosophy of the Bull Bird. His philosophy is not based on whether or not the game is interesting to watch or whether it's played well. It's whether you win. That's what counts. The Bull Bird is basically a poor sport. And that most of us basically are. Let's face it. There's not a guy listening to me tonight who doesn't like to win. Now, I'll tell you, as who was it? Some famous coach one time, some manager basis, you show me a good sport and I'll show you a loser. That's what he said. He says, you show me a good sport, I'll show you. Because after all, you're only considered a good sport when you lose the game. I mean, you run out, you leap over the tennis net and you grab your opponent's hand, you know, and you shake it. Congratulations for beating the hell out of me. That was great. You really did it. Well, of course, true winners, they don't have to do that. And I would like to salute tonight, of course, the boo capital of the world is naturally, by the very nature of the city, is Philadelphia. There's no question about it. That they have achieved eminence in the field, which is very tough. This is one of the toughest leagues because, after all, how many major league teams are there? How many major league cities are there? To achieve eminence in the booing field is no small feat, especially when you're competing with such recognized sorehead towns as New York. New York, listen, New York turns out, especially the Bronx, turns out more soreheads. If you don't think so, ask Lindsay. I mean, New York has turned out its quota of soreheads, and yet Philadelphia still is preeminent in the field of creative booing. Now, I have a note here. Mr. Shepard, the other night, he said that you, as a student of booing, said that very few people give credit to this art form, which, of course, is a people form. It's a people art form. It's not yet been codified. It's not yet been official. That's why it has such vitality. The one thing about a form of art that is practiced by the people before, you know, Clive Barnes is sent to write a critique on it, is that it has a basic animal vitality. It's just like they claim that when the early Indians in America played lacrosse, it had such a basic vitality that like 40 or 50 guys would get killed in any given game. Now, I agree that the New York Times did not cover it. Leonard Compa did not write a book on it, At Home with Your Favorite Lacrosse Player, as told to Leonard Compton. Not at all. They just went out there and wailed the hell out of each other. See, and let the chips fall where they may, and let the bones crack where they will. Oh, there were more busted skulls after any given lacrosse game, and they limped around. As a matter of fact, whole wars, did you know the whole wars were precipitated between Indian tribes because of a nasty moment in a lacrosse game that caused lifelong enemies and lifelong battles to develop between various tribes? And so it is in Philadelphia, that the Philadelphian does not boo out of the fact that his team has performed badly. He boos because he boos. It's as simple as that. Does the cow moo because the grass is not well today or the water is tasting? No, the cow moos because it is a cow. And a Philadelphia fan boos because he is a Philadelphia fan. No other reason. And that's his accepted mode of behavior at the ball game. By the way, I wish booing would get into other facets of public life. For example, if That brings up some fantastic ideas. Can you imagine, you know, you're sitting in this Broadway theater. See, nobody actually boos in a Broadway theater. They may be sitting there, 2,000 people in a Broadway house, and the show is boring, miserable. You know, just once, I would like to hear the audience go, boo, 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 you boo. They start throwing stuff up that Laurence Olivier, you boo, boo, you bum. Never. Never. You see, that's because drama, as we know it today, no longer is viable. It no longer is associated with the people. It has lost its animal vitality. It's dead on its butt, in effect. Which reminds me, this is WOR New York, and we have a couple of commercials here. Let's see. Do you have a little ding-dong in there, friend? Hit it out.
When you're 18 years old, the world is full of empty promises. Jobs that don't exist, fields that fall on your faces. But the emptiest promise of them all is the one that goes, stick with me, kid, I'm going to make something out of you. The truth is, nobody's going to make anything out of you. Your life is on your shoulders. And if you're looking for an easy one, don't try the Marines. We don't take life easy. We don't take the world for granted. And we don't take every 18-year-old that comes along. First, you have to volunteer. Then you have to get through Marine boot camp. And Marine boot camp is the toughest 9 weeks of a young man's life. Because the Marines are looking for a few good men. And we do a lot of looking before we find them.
This is Barry Farber invading your privacy, please. Do you read to get drowsy, or do you read to keep alert? If you're the kind of person who uses a book for a sleeping pill, then go on back to sleep. You do not need the Book Find Club. Any book club can keep you adequately supplied. But if reading is vital to you, if it keeps you up on what's going on, if reading stimulates you and makes you more stimulating, write down the phone number that I'm going to issue three times, because you'll be in touch with the Book Find Club. And this is a different kind of club. Book Find gives you all the club benefits, great savings on regular hardcover publisher's editions, extra bonus books, convenience. But listen to the books that make up the Book Find Club. They're not afraid of books on politics, race, religion, sexual liberation. The Book Find Club loves books that ought to be bound in asbestos. As an incentive to join now, Book Find will send you two extraordinary books for just $1 plus postage and handling. These books, typical of the books we offer, retail for about $17, and listen what you get for your $1. Galen, Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge. This is the spy story to end all spy stories, because it's real, incredibly real. The shocking exploits of Richard Galen, who was a master agent for both Hitler's intelligence service and the CIA. Also, Open Marriage, A New Lifestyle for Couples, written by Nina and George O'Neill. Is marriage on its way out, or are there going to be new way out forms of marriage? Read Open Marriage. Fascinating. Call TN7-1441, TN7-1441, for a trial membership, and get Galen and Open Marriage both for just $1 plus postage and handling. Once a member, you need buy only two more books in a year, always at discounts of up to 30% off publisher's prices plus postage and handling. Call now, TN7-1441, operators on duty around the clock, TN7-1441, or send name and address, no money, to Book Find, Box 2, WOR, New York, 10018, Book Find, Box 2, WOR, New York, 10018.
Okay? Now, you know, I would like to give you some more information here tonight, since we've taken it upon us to record the history of bullying in America is a viable. No, I was broken into bullying early in my life. My old man one time. Did I ever tell you the story of a fantastic moment that I was witness to as a kid? My old man was a fantastic Chicago White Sox fan. Now, I don't know whether you know much about the White Sox, but there is a mystique about the White Sox that transcends anything that the Mets have ever known. Because the White Sox have never really won in the memory of man. The Mets have won. Let's face it, the Mets won the world title, for heaven's sakes, just a few years ago. And they were a new ball club. They were started in 1962. They wound up winning the world championship in 1969. It's incredible. Well, my old man was born, grew, lived, and died, and the White Sox never once got above third place in his entire life. That's right. He was gone by then. Yeah, that's right. He never saw it. He never saw him win the pennant that year. And so, you know, it was nothing but defeat. And so this produces a different kind of fan. Now, he has two attitudes towards life. One, he has an intense to be on the underdog of anything. I mean, habitually, continually, and traditionally produces an intense loyalty. It transcends. Say, have you noticed how the Yankee fans all left the Yankees? Well, because they did not have a tradition of losing. That losing teams produce loyal fans, not winning teams. Now, why is this? Well, it's hard to say why, except to say that most people are losers in their lives. And that's a fact. And so they can identify with a loser better than they can identify with a winner. Now, they may cheer a winner. They may be excited when winning occurs before their eyes. But ultimately, fierce loyalty is based on a tradition of defeat. I want you to think about that for a minute there. Let that marinate. Let your brain soak that one up. That's a profound statement. Right? Because, you know, we tend to think that winning produces fans. Uh-uh. Winning produces interest. It produces talk show stuff. It produces columns in the Post. But fanatical fans are based on losers. Constant losing. And they develop a loyalty to this. And so there were two elements that worked out at Comiskey Park during my old man's tenure as a fan out there in that big ballpark. Well, one was fierce loyalty for the White Sox. Fierce. And the other, and this is the concomitant result of total losing, an insensate hatred of the other team. Now, the Yankee fans, during the days when the Yankees were winning every pennant in the world, they never hated the other clubs. What's the point of hating the Cleveland Indians when you're a Yankee fan? I mean, why should a Yankee fan hate Detroit when the Yankees murdered Detroit? Every time Detroit showed its head above the crowd, what would happen? They'd clobber them. So why hate Detroit? A little, maybe, pity for Detroit. Maybe just no thought at all of Detroit. But not so in Comiskey Park. There was an insensate hatred of winners, which happened to be almost the rest of the total league, as far as the White Sox were concerned, because during the entire lifetime of my old man, somebody in the league was winning a pennant all the time, but it wasn't the White Sox, and it was usually somebody else. I mean, it was always a different thing. First it was Cleveland, they win the pennant. You know, they had Feller and all these guys. Then it was Detroit, they win the pennant. All right? See, he was an American League fan. Then they turned right around. Then, you know, Philadelphia wins the pennant. Yeah, they actually did, you know. Even the St. Louis Browns win the pennant. That's what really bucked them. They had a one-armed outfielder. The Browns win the pennant. They did. You think I'm inventing this thing? They did. They had a one-armed outfielder. They win the pennant. The White Sox... One of the worst things about the White Sox, they were even beaten by their own farm clubs in the exhibition. You know, the White Sox play exhibition against Waterloo, lose 12-1. You know, God, why don't they bring Waterloo up? Well, they did the next year. Set the White Sox down to Waterloo. Didn't make any difference. Changed the suits on, nothing, you know. And so the old man, you know, you got to realize then what that insensate hatred produces when you have a tradition of total defeat. Insensate hatred for the opposition. Insensate. And so the old man, one day, I just tell this story. This is, you know, I might as well tell you, I haven't told you a baseball story in a long time, but I never forget this because it actually happened. And I'm sitting out there. And I'm an unwilling and almost an unconscious witness. I must have been about, I wasn't over five or six, something like that, a kid, say. Look, my old man, every Sunday, whenever he could, he would take us out to Comiskey Park, and that was a fantastic moment. And I'm sure there are a lot of kids right now, you know, the old man takes them out to Shea Stadium. What they're going to think about it years from now when they're grown-ups is very difficult for his old man to, for their old man to anticipate. But I can tell you this, it's a great moment in the kid's existence. So the old man, you know, we all said we're going to go out and watch the White Sox, and I can always remember the only time the old man would actually take the, you know, would spend the dough to go out and see the White Sox, although he was fanatical about following them. He didn't have the kind of dough where he could go out and watch them all the time, see? So he would, the only time he would actually go out and watch them was when it was really crucial, like the Yankees were coming to town. The Yankees were beating everybody all the time, see? So thousands of White Sox fans would pour out to watch the White Sox play the Yankees. They were the ultimate winners. Hence, they were hated more than anybody else. And, of course, since the White Sox were the ultimate losers, seeing a clash of oppositions like that is very exciting. Now, the second-place team battling the first-place team is not nearly as exciting as the last-place team, like 35 games out of first in the middle of May, playing the first-place team. It produces true tension. It really does. And so we'd go out there, and there'd be 55,000 people out there to see the White Sox play the Yankees. Well, now, the old man, like all White Sox fans, he hated the Yankees, and it was a love-hate relationship, see? And that's the way with every loser, every guy that's on the bottom of the rung. His attitude towards the guy on the top of the rung is love-hate. One, hatred because he ain't there. You know, he's personally on the bottom. Two, the love side comes, is he would love to be there. So it's a very difficult position to be in. So the old man is sitting out there watching the Yankees, and I was, it was the first time I ever saw the Yankees. I'll tell you an exact story about it. This is why I became a Yankee fan. It was because I came to be a Yankee fan through the back door, which is different than most of you guys here in New York. You got to be Yankee fans because they were in the Bronx. You know, that's it. They're the New York team. Well, I became a Yankee fan because the Yankees represented like the avenging wrath that would come out of New York periodically and decimate the White Sox. I mean, literally blast them right off the ball diamond. It was just unbelievable. And they were so fantastic that it was, you couldn't help but go out and watch them. Well, my old man would, he had to see the Yankees. And so it seemed like every team that I would see when I was a kid, with me and my brother, the old man, would be the Yankees. Well, so naturally I began to think of the epitome of the opponent. The epitome of the evil opponent was always the Yankees. I don't remember seeing the White Sox play the Browns, really. I don't remember the White Sox playing Boston it was always the Yankees. And so on this one occasion, which sticks in my mind because it sounds like the story I'm about to tell you, it really formed my whole attitude towards sports. It's hard to describe what happened, but, you know, why it did it, but this is what happened. I'll just describe the event. So now it is, the Yankees have come to town. The Yankees are leading the American League. It's hot. It's July. It's the middle of the season. The Yankees are maybe 15 games in the lead now, you know, and they're just running, you know, just running there. The Yankees, you know, they had this easy lope that they would just run ahead of the rest of the league. They didn't run, you know. It was the rest of the league that was running. The Yankees just sort of cooled the log up there, you know, geez, unbeatable. And so they came to Chicago on this hot day, and it was a doubleheader. It was Sunday. It was in July. And we went to see the Yankees. And now, the old man had been talking about this for about 2 weeks. We went out to see the Yankees. You know, they're coming to town, and boy, it's going to be fantastic. And, you know, we did the whole thing. My mother made a lunch. Everybody was talking for weeks before this thing. And finally, we drove to the park. Now, we lived about 20 miles or 25 miles away from the park. So when we drove into the park, it was thousands of guys out there parking the cars, you know. Oh, hey, park over here, you know. You know, those guys all around the ballpark, they're parking cars in the vacant lots and stuff. We get the Oldsmobile parked, and we joined that great parade of pilgrims going towards Comiskey Park. Now, I don't think there's anything more exciting than approaching a major league field of any type, football, baseball, this this edifice. And it's even true in basketball. When you're a fan and you're approaching the Garden. Oh wow, you know, big sign says, you know, Knicks versus Celtics tonight. That's it. You agree with me? There's an excitement in your gut. If you're not a sports fan, you will not understand it, and I don't expect you to understand it. So for heaven's sakes, tune the show out tonight. Get away. this is beyond your understanding, lady. So get out of here. We don't need you tonight. Well, approaching that park, the old man is getting tense. He's got, yeah, and the day, you know, the day of the game, he buys the Chicago Daily News, which printed on a big doubleheader. They always printed a special paper that was distributed just outside the ballpark that had a scorecard in it. They don't do that locally, but they do in Chicago, and it had a scorecard, see, and it had the lineups and all. The old man's got the scorecard in his hand, and he's beginning to sweat, and you can hear it's fantastic, because as you come closer to the stands, this enormous cliff is rising up above you. And if you've ever approached Shea Stadium from the right angle, I'm telling you, it's like the Coliseum. It really is. The Yankee Stadium is even more so, that great white walls that rise up above you. And it's an exciting just being outside and joining this crowd, moving towards it. So here I'm a kid, I'm about six, and I'm moving towards it, and there's thousands of people. I mean, just you couldn't believe the number of people that are going in this place. Well, we had our tickets already. So the old man, and he'd already gone, I got the tickets, you know, about a week before. So we're all set. We got the tickets. Well, the only tickets that you could get, that he could get at least, for that particular doubleheader, was general admission seats. Yep, and we were in the upper deck. Get this. We were in the upper deck in right field. Well, we, you know, going up the ramps, millions of people, and, you know, they're selling souvenirs, and you can hear, and you get brief, fleeting glimpses of the field as you go up these ramps. You know, you go up one ramp, and you're going up about 45 ramps to get up to the upper deck in left and right field. Say, so we're going up ramp after ramp after ramp, past the field box area, past section 27, 34, 98, past Loge and all these different things, going up these. And every couple of seconds, you would get a little fleeting glimpse of the field on it. You'd see the green grass. Once in a while, you'd just see, they're out there, it's before the game. Seeing guys are out there in field practice, you'd see this white suit run past. You know, oh, wow. And now, you hear the crowd. You know, somebody does something. And finally, we arrive in our seat. And that first view of the ballpark, for those of you who are not fans of any major sport, I must say, you have missed one of the great, one of the great human excitements is to look down on a playing field before the game. It seems pregnant with possibilities. It seems like it's there's no word to describe it, because first of all, they're generally beautiful. The sun hitting the grass, hitting the outfield grass, and those white lines, those foul lines angling off, and the bases and the home plate, the batter's boxes, and all those beautiful white geometric patterns, the fantastic green. It's just a beautiful sight. And all around it is this enormous cliff of the stadium, filled with probably 50,000 people looking down on this piece of real estate. It's an exciting scene. Really? Well, I'm not even a ball fan or anything at that time. I'm about five or six, maybe seven, something like that. And all I am is being taken to this fantastic event with the old man. Well, where are we sitting? We are sitting about 5 feet inside the foul line in the upper deck in right field. You got the picture? Now, Comiskey Park at that time had some of the longest outfield fences in baseball, like 400 feet from the plate. You know, there was no cheap home runs in Comiskey Park. It's been legendary, the White Sox Park. See, they gave up long ago having a slugging ball club. So they did the reverse of what most other clubs did, because they recognized that they get murdered by these hard-hitting balls. They moved the fences back. The only way, you see, which is quite the reverse of what most other teams did. The White Sox would move the fences back to thwart the Yankees. They didn't move them forward so that their club could get more home runs, because there's no home run hitters on the club. I mean, you could have moved the fences maybe 30 feet back of second base, and they'd have trouble reaching the stands because they hit all nothing but ground balls. So anyway, here we are. We're sitting just inside the foul line when the great traumatic moment is about to begin. Now, out comes to take fielding practice. The White Sox took fielding practice first, and they were through when we came in and sat down in our seats. All three of us are sitting there, me and my kid brother and the old man. The White Sox are now through with fielding practice. We see them going back into the dugout, and the outside, hey, there you go. He's pointing out the players, and he's saying, there's number 7, he's number 7, number 16, number 12. And now coming out of the visiting clubs, coming out of that little slit where they come out of, you know, when they come out of the clubhouse, you see these figures appearing one after the other. They're coming out, and they're coming out from the dugout, and they're coming out just casual, slow, in gray suits, the Yankees. Now, the Yankees in their traveling uniform. Now, most of you fans only see, you know, the guys that are fans, they only see their club generally wearing home uniforms. I always picture the Yankees in gray suits. That's the way I picture it. You picture them in white pinstripe, I picture them in gray suits, because that's the way they always came to Comiskey Park, gray. And they just have a little thing, didn't say Yankees, just a little thing on the front says New York. Totally understated, see? Had this dark blue cap, just said NY on the front, that's all. And on the back, little numbers. They had small numbers. And so the old man starts to holler. It's before the game, see? And for some reason, more than any other ball player, I guess he epitomized to him the hated Yankees was Lou Gehrig. I don't know why. He hated Gehrig. And he starts to holler. And one thing, like all good boo birds, he had fantastic vocal control, tremendous diaphragm. And motivation was more important than anything else. Since he hated the Yankees more than anything else, he was hollering better than he ever hollered in his life. And you know, we were sitting way up in right field, and because of the acoustics of the stand, you know, the stand is like a genuine, like a parabolic reflector. Yeah, you take a look at Shea Stadium. This is a fascinating place. You know, the sound is reflected inward. So the old man starts to holler. He hollers, "Lou! Lou! Lou! Bum! Yeah, big bum! Yeah, bum!" He's a fantastic voice. And it's just echoing down. And Gehrig, I see Gehrig down there. And Gehrig is just, you know, he's just taking infield practice. And it looked like he was right below us because we were in right field and Gehrig played first base, see? So the old man is going, "Lou Gehrig, you bum! You bum, Gehrig! You bum!" Fantastic. And it's King. See, now I'm looking up at the old man. He says, "Oh, that's a great, it's a groovy." You know, somehow I'm proud of the old man. See, and he got about 5 fans all around him. He got them going. You know, booing is contagious. It's like the smallpox or VD or something. It's contagious. And it spreads. And so the old man, "Boo!" Well, the guy about 3 rows back, he picks up, "Boo, Gehrig, you bum!" Well, here is a little nest of anti-Gehrig fanatics now. There's about 20 of them booing, see, and the old man is leading them. And he's got his hat, see, and he's wearing his hat. He had a baseball hat, see, that came from Fire Chief. I don't know where he got it, but it had Fire Chief on the front, Fire Chief Gasoline, see. So he's waving his, "Boo! Yeah, boom! Hey, Garrett! Hey, Garrett! Put it in the hat! Come on! Put it in the hat, you bum!" Well, Gary is doing nothing. He's just down there, you know, he's scooping up these ground balls. Well, the first inning begins. And the Yankees come to bat. Well, the first guy up walked. And, of course, the old man is starting to boo already. Well, that was a natural opening for any White Sox versus Yankee games. The first Yankee is on the on bases, see? The second Yankee singles. Now there's 2 guys on. And so the old man starts to holler, see, because up is coming Lou Gehrig. Well, Gehrig is a left-handed hitter, see? So Gehrig steps into the bat. Yep, steps into the batter's box, and he's got this real tight stance, and he just wiggles his tremendous shoulders. He wiggles his shoulders. The old man starts, "Boo! Get it, you bum! Boo! Boo! Boo!" Well, the first pitch, Gary just went, he just swung the bat. It looked like a, he twitched it. Just went, "My God, the ball is coming right up in the right field. It is coming right at us." And that ball sailed right over the old man's head, about 8 feet fair, and it went about 30, about maybe 30, 40 rows back of us. It just went right over our heads, see? And all the boo birds turned. It went whistling. Well, Gary cleared the bases. Well, that stopped the old man for about 30 seconds. Now he's really bugged. And he's waiting. 3 innings later, Lou Gehrig again appears at the plate, this time with runners on second and third. And so the old man stands up in his seat, and he starts hollering, "Lou! Lou, you bum! Oh, you lucky bum! You lucky bum, boo! Oh, he grooved one to you, you bum! You can't do it! Boo! He grooved it to you! What?" And he's, his neck is purple, sticking out. His eyeballs are bulging. He's hollering to Gary that the other guy, the other pitch, by now, the first pitcher, he's been gone, you know, for already 2 innings. He grooved it, see? He grooved it, you bum! The first pitch, Gary just reaches out with that twitch on the bat, like that. Well, this time, I saw a scene, friends, which... I saw a scene the like of which I will never, ever again see. One of the best boo birds who had joined the old man in cheering was sitting right below us. We were sitting, well, we were sitting one row back of the, of the partition, you know, of the edge, of the railing. Well, the guy in front was helping the old man, see. He sees the ball coming up. It's coming right at us. It's the first time I've ever been on the receiving end of a home run. It is coming right at us. And that ball ain't going up. It ain't going down. It's coming like a string. It is coming faster and faster. Well, the guy in front of us, he reaches down to grab the ball, see. It hits his hand. His hand slams up against the iron railing. It goes boing. You could see his fingers bending back like salamis. He must have busted 5 fingers. The old man's sitting there, white as a sheet. He realizes now Gehrig is aiming right at him. He's bracketed him with 2 shots. One over the head, 3 rows back. One row of foot. The next one, my God, is going to decapitate him. Well, it was the first time I ever saw a man, my old man, shut up. He was quiet for the next 2 games. Woots out through the whole doubleheader, said nothing. He just right on his scorecard. Every time Gehrig would get up, he'd just look down, right there on Gehrig. Very quiet. That day, in case you're curious, Gehrig, big headlines the next day, Gehrig in the doubleheader drove in 11 runs. And I suspect, from the way the old man acted for 2 or 3 weeks after that, that he felt that he was responsible for the defeat of the White Sox. He had goaded Gehrig into a superhuman effort. And Gehrig rose to the occasion. 3 home runs, 2 doubles, a triple, 4 singles, and he walked 9 times. Made 17 fantastic plays at first base, annihilated the White Sox single-handedly. It kind of took the wind out of the old man as a boo bird, but not for long. Because after all, Cleveland was coming in soon with Bob Feller, and he was even more hated.